President Vladimir Putin tacitly calls his U.S. counterpart a killer, firing back at Joe Biden for making a similar comment about him. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that U.S. economic terrorism has failed to bring the Iranian nation to its knees. And a new probe uncovers hundreds of cases of sexual abuse by the Catholic Church in Germany. Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Mehdi Sanjafi. It's great to have you with us. Starting with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, who tacitly calls his American counterpart a killer, and that while he's firing back at Joe Biden for making a similar comment about him. Putin says that people tend to view others as they usually see themselves. He also wished Biden good health. On Wednesday, Biden described Putin as a killer, adding that he will pay the price for meddling in the U.S. election last year. The allegations followed an American intelligence report claiming that Putin had directed efforts to swing the U.S. presidential race in favor of former President Trump. The Kremlin dismissed the allegations, saying that the remark showed that Washington is not going to get its ties with Moscow back on track. The Russian parliament members have also slammed Biden's comments as unacceptable and a watershed moment in the two countries' relations. A political commentator, Walter Smolarek, believes it's completely absurd that Joe Biden feels entitled to call another state leader a killer, since he's a notorious warmonger himself.
It began with this report from the quote-unquote intelligence community in the United States alleging that Russia attempted to interfere in the 2020 election. This report was evidence-free. Essentially, it's the CIA and all these other notorious lying spy agencies. There's this sort of absurdity to it as well, but I think it is highly significant. I mean, the fact that the Russian ambassador was recalled for consultations, that is something that indicates the seriousness of this nature. Of this matter. A final piece of this is just the complete absurdity of a U.S. president calling another head of state a killer. I mean, Joe Biden is somebody who voted for the Iraq War, for instance, that led to the death of over a million Iraqis. Joe Biden has been a notorious warmonger. I mean, he was part of the Obama administration that waged war and really shredded the fabric of Libyan society, sponsored the extremely reactionary fundamentalist rebels that tore apart Syrian society. I mean, the idea that Joe Biden feels empowered to go on TV and call another world leader a killer is just completely ridiculous, but it does have very serious diplomatic consequences, it appears.
The new U.S. administration is reportedly planning to review its policies toward the Israeli occupation of Palestine. A memo revealed to an Arab daily says that the Biden administration will push for a two-state solution based on the pre-1967 lines with mutually agreed land swaps. The memo shows that the U.S. is planning to announce a $15 million in aid package for Palestinians to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. Washington also planning to roll back some policies, such as U.S. legitimating Israeli settlement activities in the occupied territories. The previous administration under President Trump had given the green light to Israel to embark on its agenda, including settlement construction. Washington also relocated its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem Al-Quds, in a move that sparked international outcry. Now, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said that the pressure imposed on the Iranian people has failed to bring them to their knees.
Over the past year, we have once again shown our ironclad resilience, from confronting economic terrorism, targeting our access to food and medicine in order to bring us to our knees, to standing up to modern-day state terrorists who murdered the pioneers of our defense and scientific advancement. And all of this amid the deadliest pandemic humanity has seen in a century.
In a message congratulating the Persian New Year, Zarif said that the Iranian people have endured unjust suffering on a massive scale over the past years. He said that the people are now stronger and determined more than ever to decide their own destiny. The foreign minister noted that the Iranian economy is becoming immunized against outside coercion, with industrial production leading the country's growth. Zarif expressed Iran's willing to expand engagement with its neighbors and beyond for building a better world. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a webinar dubbed Terrorism and Media. The event seeks to shed light on how the West has changed the definition of terrorism to serve its own interests in the region. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Who is a terrorist? Rights activists in Tehran say the West does not have a unified definition of the word terrorism. A case in point, they say, is the Syrian conflict, where the U.S. calls the terrorists opposition groups who aim to topple the Assad government. And Hezbollah, which is a popular party in Lebanon, is branded by the U.S. as a terrorist organization.
The U.S. and EU change the meaning of terrorism based on their interests. Anyone who stands against their adventurism in the region is called terrorist, and anyone who serves their interests is not a terrorist. General Soleimani was the number one nemesis of Daesh terrorists, but the U.S. assassinated him and called him a terrorist.
Having lost over 17,000 people in terror attacks, Iran regards itself a major victim of terrorism. Since Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or the MKO, has had a dark history of assassinations and bombings, targeting both Iranian statesmen and people.
The majority of terror victims in Iran were targeted by the MKO organization. In 2012, the U.S. removed the MKO from its list of terrorist organizations. The move is still regarded by Iranians as a clear example of U.S.'s dual take on terrorism.
In 2012, and after the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, the group was relocated from a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials. This example easily spills the beans on the U.S.'s intention and why it is not willing to call the MKO terrorists.
Iranians abhor the MKO terrorists because they do not represent Iranians' ideas. But the U.S. doesn't care about what Iranians think. The MKO terrorists serve the U.S. interests. That's all they need to be approved by Americans.
I lost my father in a terror attack carried out by the MKO terrorists 40 years ago. My dad is one of the 12,000 Iranians killed by Mujahideen-e-Khalq. So it's clear who the U.S. is supporting. The U.S. and the terrorists are on the same team.
The webinar was held simultaneously with the 46th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Organizers of the Tehran webinar say this concurrence relays a message to the UN. That is, an action toward the double standards by the West on terrorism is translated into a green light for more rights violations by the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A Lebanese Prime Minister designate Saad Hariri has met with President Aoun to discuss the formation of a new government. And that meeting came after Aoun asked Hariri to resign if he finds himself unable to patch up a cabinet. We're joined by our Lebanon correspondent Nadia Saleh for more on that story.
Well, we had a positive step, we may say, today with this meeting between Prime Minister designate Saad Hariri and the President, Michel Aoun. It was brief, but we do know that it was weighty. It was very significant. They agreed both that we do have a catastrophe here in the country, and the only way of stopping this deterioration, this economic, socio-economic and political collapse in the country is by actually forming a new cabinet. So they both agreed on that. However, they failed to agree on this today. This is just part of the procrastination that we live in Lebanon on a daily basis. So basically, the state of affairs is quite frozen. It is the same. We have a dire socioeconomic crisis in the country. We have people who are blocking roads on a daily basis, people who are angry at the situation. The price of the dollar is getting even more drastic, and it's become in a state where people cannot deal with it. People cannot buy even necessary basic food stuff that they need. So this is one of the major problems that we have. Now, Prime Minister Saad Hariri did say that we agreed that the only way that we can stop this catastrophe and this collapse is by actually forming a cabinet. That is one positive step that we can say. However, they failed to agree on this today. He did mention also, however, that there will be a follow-up meeting next Monday to pave way for talks, but he did not say that we should have a formation of cabinet on Monday.
Well, so many talks so far. Let's hope that something will happen in Lebanon toward the government. Now, the Armenian Prime Minister has announced early parliamentary elections on June 20th as his country is grappling with a political deadlock. Nikol Pashinyan says the move is the best way out of Armenia's current political crisis. Now, that amid continued standoff between the Prime Minister and the armed forces. In February, Army Chief Oneg Gasparian asked Pashinyan to step down, but the Prime Minister turned down his call and fired him. The Premier has been under fire for his handling of last year's conflict with Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The six-week war ended with a Russian-brokered peace deal, which is seen by many Armenians as a disastrous outcome. An independent study by the Roman Catholic Church has revealed hundreds of cases of sexual violence allegedly committed by the clergy and laymen in the German city of Cologne since 1975. The report found over 200 alleged cases of sexual assault and 314 victims between 1975 and 2018. It says more than half of the victims were minors under the age of 14. Two Cologne church officials have been suspended over covering up abuse cases. A report in 2018 found some 1,600 clergymen had committed some type of sexual attack against 3,600 minors, mostly boys, and that happened between 1946 and 2014. The revelations mirror pedophile scandals in countries like Australia, Chile, France, and the U.S. The British Health Secretary is saying that the European Union will face consequences if it violates COVID-19 vaccine supply contracts.
We fully expect those contracts to be delivered on, because there are very significant consequences to breaking contract law.
Matt Hancock says that all countries need to respect the law, expressing confidence that the EU will live up to its commitments. He was responding to an EU threat to block vaccine exports to the UK. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said that a block may halt exports of COVID vaccines to the UK unless it has started shipping shots to the EU. Brussels has accused Britain, the main producer of AstraZeneca vaccines, of imposing a de facto ban on vaccine exports. That's a claim that London has rejected. Now, this while the EU is facing an acute shortage of COVID-19 jabs. The United Nations Refugee Agency has voiced concern that refugees across the globe are facing a long struggle to get COVID vaccines. It says that vaccinating some of the world's most vulnerable refugees could drag on beyond 2021 due to the slow rollout of the jabs in host countries. The World Body says it's seeking some $455 million to tackle the additional problems posed in protecting refugees from the effects of the pandemic. According to the UN's latest statistics, there are around 80 million forcibly displaced people worldwide. Those include some 46 million internally displaced people, more than 26 million refugees, and 4 million asylum seekers. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits still remains high 1 year into the COVID outbreak, even as the economy gets another round of stimulus. The U.S. Labor Department says the jobless claims climbed to 770,000 in mid-March, a 45,000 increase from the previous week. Now, President Joe Biden signed a $1.9 trillion relief package aimed at turning the economy around. It's now the 52nd straight week that claims stand above the worst seen during the 2008 financial crisis. Applications for unemployment aid in the U.S. had never topped 700,000 in any 1 week before the pandemic. However, more than 18 million people receiving aid as of February shows that the employment crisis caused by the pandemic continues. Britain has announced plans to increase its nuclear weapons stockpile by more than 40%. The U.K. has justified the move by claiming it merely wants to defend itself against increased security threats. And that is why campaigners and politicians have criticized the plan, saying it amounts to a violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and international law.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson unveiled the UK's plan to expand its nuclear warhead stockpile by at least 40%. He justified the move by claiming that it merely aims to ensure Britain's security in a more risky global environment, as it faces technological and doctrinal threats. the decision would end Britain's gradual nuclear disarmament program, as London had been committed to cutting its nuclear stockpile to 180 warheads by the mid-2020s. On March 16, the British government released a long-awaited review of defense, security, and foreign policy. A key piece of the document centered on the strengthening of the UK's nuclear deterrence, and as widely reported, the government plans to increase the cap on the stockpile of nuclear warheads from 180 to 260. The review also noted that Britain reserves the right to withdraw assurances that it will not use nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear armed state. The announcement prompted British campaigners to slam the UK government's plan to increase the country's nuclear weapons stockpile, which was described as a move that amounts to a violation of international law. The planned increase also drew criticism from the Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer. He accused the Tory government of having a global reputation for breaking international law. Also, the Scottish National Party defense spokesperson, Stuart MacDonald, slammed the increase as nothing short of abhorrent. The decision also prompted international outcry. The Kremlin slammed the decision, saying that it harms international stability and strategic security. Russia also stressed that the presence of nuclear warheads threatens global peace.
Well, there is no excuse, none whatsoever, for the UK to increase the threshold on its number of nuclear warheads. And you know that there's no good reason and no excuse for that, because the government itself has not even tried to provide an explanation, a detailed explanation, for why this might be the case.
Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. 30 people have been killed in clashes between government troops and militia forces in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. The army says 11 civilians, 2 soldiers, and a policeman were among the dead. Fighting broke out when militant attacked 2 villages in the province of Ituri and lasted 2 days. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is grappling with numerous conflicts, especially in remote areas in the country's east. The region has been gripped by militia violence for a quarter of a century. A U.S.-based monitor says that more than 120 armed groups were operating last year in the eastern region. Russia is hosting a multilateral conference aimed at reviving the stalled Afghan peace process. The Moscow summit includes African political leaders and a Taliban delegation, as well as representatives from the U.S., Pakistan, and China. The Russian foreign minister has expressed hope that negotiations would pave the way for more inter-Afghan talks. Sergei Lavrov also urged Washington and the Taliban to remain committed to their obligations under a peace deal reached in Doha last year. The agreement signed by the former U.S. administration and the militant group requires Washington to remove its troops from Afghanistan at the end of April. The Taliban also promised to stop attacks on international forces stationed in the war-torn country. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Live coverage of Nowruz in Arabi English Radio
on Saturday, March 20th, around 9:30 UTC.
Stay with us.
If a climate emergency resolution is to mean anything or is to be taken seriously, it must mean that the government in question puts a halt to the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure expansion within its jurisdiction, says Woody Hastings, researcher, in an article titled A Tale of Two Cities, one planning for 2050s, the other for 1950s. Stay tuned for more. This is a tale of two cities separated by a mere 11 miles, each with radically different approaches to local planning in the midst of one hell of a climate emergency. Petaluma and Novato are two cities in San Francisco's North Bay community. The region has been pummeled by a series of unprecedented enormous wildfires over the past 6 years. This past September, it included what locals call the Orange Sky Day. It was a day when the smoke from the regional wildfires was so thick that the sun was blotted out and it was dark all morning. When it did finally start to get light around noon, the sky had an apocalyptic orange hue that lingered for days. Events like the Orange Sky Day in other parts of the world, be they droughts, floods, heat waves, or other anomalous weather, are in part what has inspired nearly 2,000 governments, large and small around the world, to adopt climate emergency resolutions. Most of the cities in San Francisco's North Bay have adopted such resolutions, and that includes Novato in Marin County, that just adopted its resolution in November 2020, and Petaluma in Sonoma County, that has had theirs on the books since May 2019. If a climate emergency resolution is to mean anything or is to be taken seriously, it must mean that the government in question puts a halt to the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure expansion within its jurisdiction. There does not appear to be universal understanding or acceptance of this basic logic, summed up pretty well by the adage, "If you're already in a hole, stop digging." On February 22, 2021, two events were juxtaposed that illuminate the stark difference in policy direction. On that night in Novato, the Planning Commission voted to approve a 28-dispenser mega gas station at an existing Costco store. If built, it will be the largest gas station in Marin County, in a location where about 10 others are already in operation. The Novato City Council subsequently approved it against a strong showing of public opposition. On that same February 19, Petaluma, the City Council voted unanimously to adopt an ordinance that permanently prohibits the construction of new gas stations within Petaluma city limits. Petaluma recognizes the climate crisis, the need for improved active and public transportation options, the changing market dynamics around gasoline and gas cars, the advances in electric vehicle technology, and state-level policy trends aiming for economic decarbonization, and wisely is planning for 2050. Novato, tragically, is still planning for 1950. In Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, themes include social justice and good versus evil. In every drop that comes out of a gasoline dispenser, there is a trail of devastation for communities and the environment around the world that leads all the way back to the point of extraction of crude oil from the ground. People and wildlife are poisoned and/or displaced by effluent and emissions from those operations. Low-income communities along rail and road waves are threatened by the hazard of oil and gas transportation. Communities of color near refineries and gas processing facilities face respiratory disorders, cancer, and death rates much higher than the national average. Indigenous communities around the world are severely impacted by pumping and pipelines. There are choices to be made at the local level that have impacts far beyond their city limits. It is high time to end this century plus of evil and injustice. Petaluma was allegedly the first city in the nation to adopt its new gas station prohibition, and work is underway to leverage it. In Sonoma County, a grassroots group called the Coalition Opposing New Gas Stations rose up in mid-2019 in opposition to a proposed gas station, which was defeated. Since then, two other gas stations' proposals have been defeated. No one wants to spend their time battling proposals to build obsolete polluting infrastructure. So this group focuses its efforts on changing outdated 20th century rules that are still on the books in counties and cities across the U.S. that allow gas stations to be built like they are ice cream stands. The time is right for a movement to include other cities and counties across the U.S. and across the world. Local governments must plan for 2050, not 1950.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Oklahoma City, directed by Barack Goodman. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Matt Turner, who is the senior editor of Evolve Politics. Now, in 1995, Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier deeply influenced by far-right ideology, detonated a truck full of explosives in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. This resulted with 168 people killed, including 19 children, and 675 injured in the blast. This documentary traces the events, including the deadly encounters between US citizens and law enforcement at Ruby Ridge and Waco, that led to McVeigh to commit the worst act of domestic terrorism in US history.
There's heavy damage. About a third of the building has been blown away.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on defenseless citizens.
I could hear yelling, screaming. He said, "You can't go up there, it's too dangerous." But I just kept saying, "Our baby's hard now." And I thought, who has come in here and done this terrible thing?
FBI hotline.
We had all kinds of experts looking for clues.
Because at the very first, they had no idea who did it.
Then we started getting calls about Middle Easterners. Start looking for Middle Easterners.
But then someone I spoke to said, "Do you know what day it is?" And immediately it hit me. This is about Waco.
Members of the community out there had heard automatic weapons fire and explosions coming from the compound.
Take a breath. Pick up the phone. The negotiator wants to speak with you.
You went back on your word.
That is a lie.
When I saw the fire, all I could think about were the children in there.
Nine adults came out. Not one of them brought a child out.
You're next! Wake up and understand! You're next!
They were really imagining this fortress.
It's the new thing in America. It's called the militia. No constable's going to come and break their door down. They'll shoot them first.
FBI agents surround the cabin.
At that point, there was a shootout.
When it was all said and done, Sammy and Vicky Weaver were dead.
Any cure! Any cure!
The events at Ruby Ridge lit up the radical right.
Call yourself an American? These are Americans! You're a disgrace to the white race!
And they decided that they would basically declare war on the U.S.
There'll be a lot of blood running one day.
It was just a lightning moment of recognition. This was the guy in the sketch.
Last night, Timothy McVeigh was charged in the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
I think everybody felt this sudden sense of betrayal. I think everyone thought, you're one of us.
If you continue with shit like Ruby Ridge and Waco, this is what's going to happen.
Timothy McVeigh, he was the creation of the white supremacist movement. There was a strong connection.
All these events, they were all connected.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Oklahoma City was a documentary that provided a great insight into the psyche of white supremacists, and also it was incredibly detailed in the events leading up to the devastating Oklahoma City bombing itself. Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Oklahoma City?
Well, it's made by PBS, which of course is the American Public Service broadcaster, and I think it has a recognizable PBS style. So you get reels of archive footage broken up by talking heads, expert talking heads, and sort of slow rostrum camera pans over white supremacist text and photographs that show the consequences of the actions of people like McVeigh. So I think it's good TV rather than something especially cinematic, but what it does have is this very strong procedural hook. It's chaptered. Every chapter has a title like The Flame, The Spark, The Inferno, and there is a sense that after some extremely heated, explosive activity, we're going to have this reassertion of cool rationality. We're going to look at these events from a distance, from a historical perspective, and look
PBS
at...
PBS seem to be really great at these sort of things.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what they do.
Similar films in the past.
Yes, I think, you know, bringing that sort of cool-headedness to a hot-headed act of violence and seeing Oklahoma as this tragic endpoint at the end of a chain of events that really need to be learned from.
And Matt, what did you make of Oklahoma City?
Well, to be honest with you, I think, given the current circumstances in the United States, I think it should be shown in every classroom in America, because it does really teach you the dangers of how white supremacists can take advantage of young, disillusioned men who are probably, you know, skeptical about government involvement in their own lives anyway.
So following just what Mike said, do you think this documentary then has high relevance to today, even though this happened over 20 years ago?
I think now more than ever, it's been completely and utterly relevant. I mean, if you look at the rise of Donald Trump, you look at the rise of white supremacy in the United States, you know, they are gaining momentum again, and they are kind of emboldened by the rise of the alt-right. You know, we are seeing more and more militias kind of coming back.
Making a comeback.
Exactly. And we're kind of reaching a really, really dangerous territory now where you can kind of feel the tension when you go on alt-right marches and white supremacist marches. Neo-Nazis used to be hidden in the shadows, probably ever since this attack for the last 20 years, but now they're starting to come back out and start to be a little bit more vocal.
In the mainstream, especially.
Ruby Ridge, more even than Robert Matthews in The Order, became a central calling card and rallying card for the far right. For them, the government was after Weaver's guns and his religion. And guns and religion became the twin pillars of the white supremacist movement.
In late summer 1992, after Ruby Ridge, several members of the extremist movement saw that as an opportune moment to sort of gather everybody together and let's raise hell about this.
One race, one vote, one nation, one people, one homeland, we're going to have it!
Louis Beam, a former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, said, now is the time for you as an individual to commit overt acts of anti-government violence. Essentially, anybody representative of government or law enforcement was a fair and reasonable target.
The government is an enemy of the people. And in this war, it's an all or nothing. You know, we either going to win as the white race or we're going to lose.
Kind of extremist thinking coming from the white supremacists there. And Mike, what else did we learn about white supremacists from this documentary? How do you think they were portrayed?
Well, I mean, we were talking about other PBS documentaries. The PBS documentary this most reminded me of was the Ken Burns film about the Civil War, you know, a sort of landmark documentary series. Mm-hmm. Because it, in some respect, it's as though history keeps repeating itself. Like, so there are people in the impoverished south of America who now look at, you know, late 20th, 21st century America, which is a place of integration, which is a place where there are multiple voices, where everybody seems to have a place, there's a place for everyone. And they look at that and they say, well, actually, I'd much rather live in the America of the 17th, 18th, 19th century, you know, where there was this white Christian monoculture and everybody knew their place. And I think, you know, we speak about white power. I think actually white power is white anger, the fact that, you know, things aren't what they used to be.
And I just wanted to go back to the documentary now and talking about Timothy McVeigh. What did you make of his character and how is he portrayed in this film?
Well, he's a fascinating character because, you know, in many ways, he's the ultimate patriot. You know, he served his country during the first Iraq war. I think his story chimes with that of a lot of people, a lot of soldiers who were sent out to Iraq and came back and started questioning their own place in American society, that they were a tool of the state and they were useful so long as they were fighting certain battles out there. What do they do once they're back on the home front and the government seems to have abandoned them? And so he's a patriot who comes to turn against his own country, which is a sort of central irony of this documentary.
And Matt, if I could turn to you and ask you sort of the same question. About Timothy McVeigh, we see his process of radicalization. He was a former US soldier.
Yeah.
What impression did you make of this, of this radicalization process?
I thought it was really, really interesting. You know, kind of like we said, he was a soldier, he went out to serve his country, and he definitely was an arm of the state, and he came back and he became incredibly disillusioned with, you know, his life as a soldier, his life in the army. And I think the really, really dangerous thing is that there are kind of three separate strands of the far-right movement which he appears to have been radicalized by. Right, there is the kind of Christian fundamentalist side of things, as we saw in the kind of Waco siege.
Yes, in the clip it just said guns and sort of religion go hand in hand with white supremacy.
Yeah, no, definitely. You've kind of got the NRA movement, the guns, but then you've also got that kind of neo-Nazi white pride kind of movement, which does usually kind of seep its way into both the religious and the kind of gun control debates. And it's maybe, you know, once upon a time it wasn't always dominant in those debates, but now it absolutely is.
And I just wanted to bring in the point you made earlier before the other VTV played about Donald Trump. You said that we see a rise now in far-right movements. But with Timothy McVeigh, he was angry at the government then. But do you think he'd be happy with the government now if he were alive?
You know what, I think he would be happy that Donald Trump got elected, because he did run on that kind of populist right platform, something which would appeal, you know, a lot to Timothy McVeigh. But a few years down the line, when people start to realise that Donald Trump is just another careerist in the White House who isn't going to enact kind of real change in the interest of ordinary people, in the interest of kind of communities up and down America, that's when he'll start to feel even more betrayed, for example, because he's kind of put faith in the government and in a politician such as Donald Trump for once in his lifetime, hypothetically. And I think he would still be disappointed, and that's when it could get really catastrophic.
We'll just have to leave it there just for now. We'll continue the discussion in the next part.
White supremacists like Beam saw in the standoff the same issues that they had decided were important with Randy Weaver. The Branch Davidians were not white supremacists, but now a broader section of the far right sees itself in Waco and says, we're being suppressed for our beliefs and our guns.
There was a hill that was about 3 miles from Mount Carmel. It was on a rise that was high enough that you could just barely see Mount Carmel in the distance. This was as close as members of the public could get to the standoff.
You're next! You're next! Wake up and understand! You're next!
All sorts of folks felt moved to come down to see what was going on at Waco.
Just arrived today. I guess somebody told me a lot of people would be scared to put something on, you know, like this.
Timothy McVeigh had already apparently been very concerned about what had happened at Ruby Ridge. So he came down to Waco and saw bumper stickers with pro-gun, anti-government slogans. He saw the raid as clear evidence of what the government would do to try to confiscate guns and persecute gun owners.
The documentary argues that the siege at Ruby Ridge in 92 and then the Waco attacks in 93 were the primary motivations behind Oklahoma City bombing in 95. Now, Mike, what did you make of the part in the documentary where the government gets involved in these sieges at Ruby Ridge and Waco? Was it a game changer?
It certainly was. I mean, I think, strangely enough, that part of the film reminded me of the most recent series of Homeland, the TV series, which is doing a not dissimilar storyline in terms of dealing with white supremacy and a sort of Waco, Ruby Ridge-like siege. And what that show is doing at the moment is showing just how difficult it is to enter into any kind of debate with white supremacists. And I think in part it's down to the great American love of free speech. And, you know, white supremacists, the minute they feel their voices are being suppressed, they feel like they're being censored, or, you know, they feel like they're being victimized, which leads to an even greater bunker mentality. And that, you know, the second problem here is the access to military-grade weaponry and explosives, which you don't get in any other part of the world.
They spent about $43,000 or something, and that's why they went to raid them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's almost unthinkable on this side of the Atlantic, but it is something that recurs in American history because people do have easy access to that kind of weaponry.
And Matt, would you agree with what Mike said? And I also wanted to add that I think one of the messages in the film was that there was a lot of government complicity, and they bared a lot of responsibility in Oklahoma City bombing because of the way they mishandled the events at Waco and Ruby Ridge.
I'd say Ruby Ridge, absolutely. You know, it's kind of been put in official documents that the government did mishandle that situation and that the FBI and other forces did go beyond what is kind of considered reasonable force. You know, kind of Randy Weaver was given a considerable payout afterwards. You know, he spent maybe 18 months in jail tops, I think. Wake, on the other hand, I think is an entirely different beast. You know, I think in the documentary you would actually see a recording about when the FBI were putting in tear gas and about to raid the building. The kind of Branch Davidians started pouring fuel and pouring petrol, and it basically turned into a suicide cult by the end of it. And to me, that is no fault of the government. They did have to go in there, I truly believe.
But of course the far right spins that a moment and made it seem as if the government had put the fire at Waco.
And that is another reason why it's incredibly relevant in this day and age, because we are in an era of, you know, quote-unquote fake news, the rise of social media, the rise of online content, the rise of a lot more conspiracy theories, particularly on the alt-right. People believe what they read on the internet if it fits their kind of pre-existing hatred of the government. And that's why a lot of far-right conspiracy theories about Waco actually gained so much steam and definitely kind of played a part in radicalising.
Did you want to add anything to that?
I mean, you do see, it's almost the birth of fake news, you know, halfway through this film, where they're showing re-editing that footage of the storming of the compound to suggest something entirely different to the far-right demographic, you know. And you can certainly see that there's the birth of something in this incident, which still resonates even today.
It's incredibly symbolic and enlightening, actually.
The Murrah Building had numerous federal offices. It had HUD, it had the ATF, it had general accounting offices, it had military recruiters, the Social Security Administration, the DEA was in there. And there is some question as to whether or not McVeigh knew there was a daycare in there, but he also kind of indicated that it wouldn't have made the difference anyway. Michael Fortier began feeling uneasy about doing this. He suddenly visualized what was going to happen. He points out that there were probably going to be innocent people inside that are going to die.
McVeigh told him there has to be a body count. He said, the government is not going to sit up and take notice unless there's a body count. They can always build a new building, but a body count will get their attention.
From a military perspective, to get a message across, you need to hurt them where they hurt the most. The only way they're going to feel something, and the only way they're going to get the message, is with a body count.
I think many might be surprised to learn that actually the Oklahoma City bombing was the biggest act of domestic terrorism in the U.S. And I did some research, and actually, you know, ever since 9/11, despite the focus on so-called Islamic terrorism, but since 2001, since then, the number of violent attacks on U.S. soil inspired by far-right ideology has spiked to an average of more than 300 a year, according to a study by the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. So Matt, why do you think it is that these attacks by white supremacists don't get as much media attention?
I think, you know, there are a lot of complex reasons for that, but I think one of the main ones is obviously we've had Bush, we've had Obama, and now we have Trump, all of which have kind of intervened in the Middle East and want to kind of justify those interventions. And the easiest way to do it, the easiest way to rally public support, is to inflate the threat to your own domestic land and pretend that it is absolutely essential to intervene in these countries to stop attacks, when in reality, the vast majority of attacks, as you've already said, on American soil have been committed by mostly far-right, young, white men. And they don't get deemed terrorist attacks in the news. They get kind of castigated as lone wolves or mentally deranged. And then they never really want to kind of pick apart the ideology behind why these people are committing these attacks.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary implied this sort of point, this message from the film, especially by the media coverage of Waco, of Oklahoma City bombing, rather?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, there's a very distinct segment of the film which reports the initial response to the attack, which was, you know, to suggest that this wasn't, you know, white supremacists, it wasn't, you know, a Middle Eastern terrorist of some kind. And this seems to be a trope that happens time and time again now in the mainstream media. I think after, you know, major events happening, you know, there's always a rush to judgment, a rush to point fingers. And I think, you know, because this is such an explosive issue, having actually had that kind of, you know, to step back and to look at the facts and examine the evidence, you know, we need time to do that. And I think more and more, with the way the internet and social media has sped things up, people are rushing to judgment much more. You know, but this was before that, you know, and people were still pointing fingers and rushing to judgment.
So the internet probably has exacerbated that problem.
Exactly, yeah, I think so.
And Matt, why do we see then this consistent growth then of far-right ideology, despite the fact that we're sort of in the digital age and people should know better?
I'm not sure people do know better, to be honest with you. I mean, if you look at the actual volume of kind of far-right propaganda on websites like Twitter and Facebook now, you know, it is genuinely obscene. I mean, Facebook have recently decided to finally permanently ban the Britain First Facebook page, which is obviously a good start because they do kind of put forward a lot of inaccuracies, a lot of half-truths.
But Trump actually retweeted a few of their tweets that were spreading Islamophobic messages.
He did, and I think that shows a kind of shocking lack of judgment, particularly from the President of the United States, to kind of indulge in this kind of far-right conspiratorial nonsense. But the more serious point is, you know, Donald Trump is a hugely influential man, you know, President of the United States, and the fact that he's pushing those conspiracies means that, you know, you can talk about the NRA, you can talk about the religious fundamentalists, but in reality, you know, Donald Trump right now is exacerbating the problem more than anybody else.
And we're just coming to the end of the show now. Mike, could I get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, certainly. I mean, it is worth seeing, and, you know, it does have a huge amount of relevance to the situation we're in today. I think it's also very moving, we should say. You know, I mean, towards the end, it points at the fact that Timothy McVeigh wanted to take up arms and overturn the current government to install the government of the people. But actually, there's a final montage that shows the workers inside the Oklahoma City building, who were the people, who were fathers and mothers and daughters and sons, doing their best for their country, who happened to be in completely the wrong place at the wrong time.
Very well put, and I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Chambayat.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.